What do we really know about biomarkers?
Family clustering of staph infections.
What's the state of practice of euthanasia?
And a new approach to breast cancer studies.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on July 8th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to start with the New England Journal of Medicine. You served this up as a new approach to studies with regard to breast cancer, and sure enough, it was a new approach. I don't really get it myself, so I'm hoping you could explain it.
In the past, this has usually involved randomized controlled trials. Let's approach it in a different way. Let's give what's called neoadjuvant therapy. Adjuvant therapy means in addition to the main therapy, neo means upfront. So let's say, for example, you have a breast cancer that's, an inch or more in size, and we know we're going to remove it. Well, let's give a chemotherapy agent before we remove it. Let's do the primary therapy, take it out surgically, and then let's take out the lymph nodes and look for a little micrometastasis, because we know that correlates well with long-term survival without recurrence of the disease. Now, we can do that in several hundred women over a short period of time. Furthermore, we can modify the neoadjuvant therapy in a way that if we administer something and it's not effective, we move to either a different agent or to a different dose. That's called an adaptive approach. So what these investigators did in women with breast cancer about an inch in size, that is stage 2 or stage 3 breast cancer, they determined different biomarkers, whether they were estrogen responsive or progesterone responsive or something called HER2 positive or negative. And based upon that, they gave them the usual chemotherapy and surgical therapy. Beforehand, they gave them different neoadjuvant therapy targeted towards these particular receptors. And they could alter that. And here's what they discovered. Without getting into the details of the different medications, they tested the backbone therapy and two different medications in some that were HER2 positive, but estrogen and progesterone negative. And in the other group, they were all three negative. And they're able to show that some of the chemotherapies were twice as effective than others. Then they're going to take that into larger trials. So this is the new treatment paradigm.
Sounds to me like what underpins this adaptive approach is really the molecular assessment of the tumor.
That's part of it. It's looking at pathologic remission rather than clinical remission, so we can do it in a shorter period of time. And it's also adaptive as well. That is, if the particular agent you're using or agents you're using isn't effective, you can move on to the next one. Your recent results inform the trial design.
Then in toto, would you say that your assessment of this approach to clinical trials is practical and will probably be adopted in lots of other areas?
I think so, Elizabeth, because you can do it in a smaller number of individuals, adapt the therapy, you get the results much quicker. As we develop new agents very quickly, and we have 18 new types of targeted specific therapies just over the last year, it allows us to continue to modify these studies rather than waiting for decades for results.
Interesting. And finally, I would say that the fact that they use triple negative breast cancer in this, which has been a group that's been traditionally hard to treat, is really positive news for a lot of women.
Absolutely. And in 50% of the women, they were able to demonstrate with the more effective therapy that there was no pathologic evidence of the disease, even in micro dissection of the lymph nodes.
Excellent. Since we've got these biomarkers then rattling around in this study, let's turn now to an Institute of Medicine report taking a look at, and I said, what do we really know about biomarkers?
So Elizabeth, we're departing a little bit because you and I are usually very fastidious about making sure that we only report on studies. We very infrequently report on recommendations, but I think this is important, and I think it ties in well with what we just recently talked about, and that is the use of biomarkers. We've spent a lot of time talking about personalized medicine, and what the Institute of Medicine said is we have a lot of work to do to make sure that we have validated the biomarkers, we've collected the samples in a systematic way that we can understand what the clinical application is. So the Institute of Medicine has made 10 recommendations for advancing the appropriate use of biomarker tests for what are called molecularly targeted therapies.
Let's talk about, you don't have to go through all 10 of those recommendations, of course, but maybe you could synthesize that into just a couple abstract version sentences, if you will.
Okay. A couple of the key things is we need to have accreditation for the standardized biomarker test. And we have to develop a reimbursement model. And the last thing is we need to have some sort of a sustainable national repository of biomarker tests. And from that, we can determine what therapies might be effective.
Was there anything in there about biomarkers that right now have a lot of legs with regard to clinical utility?
No, there wasn't. This is not only with respect to cancer therapy, but other inflammatory conditions or arthritic conditions. These were just basically broad recommendations that would apply across different disease states.
Well, we're sure going to be hearing more about that one. Let's turn to an interesting topic to me, something that sort of goes with one we talked about last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I said the state of practice with regard to euthanasia internationally.
Well, in almost 11 years of podcasting with you, we've not covered this particular topic. So before we proceed, let me make sure our listeners understand the difference between euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. With euthanasia, the physician actively and intentionally ends a patient's life by some medical means, like injection of a neuromuscular relaxant or some other agent, because of the patient's condition. With physician-assisted suicide, the physician actually prescribes the drugs and the patient self-administers them. This particular article was unique in that it's one of the few that I know of that has looked at interviews and looked at surveys over 70 years in countries that allow euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, like the Netherlands, Belgium, Colombia, Canada, and Luxembourg. Whereas opposed to the United States, we don't allow euthanasia, but five states do allow physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont, and California. Here's what was discovered. In the United States, and I'll focus on that, less than 20% of the physicians have reported even receiving any requests from their patients for either euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, and less than 5% have actually complied to those requests. In Oregon and Washington, where physician-assisted suicide is permitted, less than 1% of the licensed physicians actually write prescriptions for physician-assisted suicides each year. Now, there was concern that as this was permitted, it would become more rampant. In fact, over the last 20 years, the number of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicides has actually decreased somewhat. Importantly, most of these occur in people with cancer, although sometimes in neurodegenerative disease. And it's interesting, I would have thought that pain was the most common reason, but it's usually due to the fact that the individuals lose autonomy, they're less able to enjoy life, they have a loss of dignity, or they lose their bodily functions.
I would have also predicted that the pain aspect would be more prominent. I guess one of the things that we have reported on before has been the idea that when people know this is available, they just want to know it's available. They don't always make that election.
I think you're absolutely right. These are individuals that life will be less than 6 months in duration. They know that the end is near, and they want to know they can die with dignity, and the physicians allow them to do so.
I like that. Let's turn now to Annals of Internal Medicine, a look at something that runs in families, Staphylococcus aureus.
If you don't have enough family problems, this was an interesting one. There is some animal studies that suggest there's a genetic predisposition to bacterial infection with Staph aureus. How might you tease that out? Do a cohort study. Identify individuals that have had Staph infection. We're talking about in the blood. So this is called Staph bacteremia. And then look to see if their relatives also subsequently develop Staph aureus infection. You can do that in a country like Denmark, where they have all the results of the hospitalizations. So over about a 19-year period, they looked at over 18,000 index cases of Staph aureus. And then they looked at their siblings or their parents. That involved almost 35,000 individuals who were followed up for about 8 years after the index case was identified. And sure enough, their first-degree relatives were 250% more likely to also develop a blood infection. And by the way, if it was your sibling, you were 5 times more likely. If it was a parent, you were about twice as likely. Now you say, well, that's because they were exposed, they developed the same infection. Well, actually, that's not true, because the spouses didn't get the infection. When the sibling or parent got it, it was oftentimes a different type of Staph infection. So that suggests there's a genetic predisposition. It's not just exposure.
Why do we care about this?
We care about it because Staph bacteremia is a serious condition. If someone develops it, the mortality is about 25 to 30%. And by the way, these infections weren't in people that were old and debilitating that chronic disease. These were in relatively young, healthy individuals. If we can identify those individuals or establish that there's a genetic predisposition, then we try to identify exactly what that is.
That brought us full circle back to those biomarkers. We'll be hearing more about that. On this note then, I'm going to talk about, I'm sort of stuck. I'm halfway between the breast cancer and the euthanasia. Which of them do you think I should talk about in the blog?
I would suggest the euthanasia just because it's not something we typically cover. And I think it's a 70-year study. I like it.
All righty. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.